Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to be with you today. As always, we begin with the latest on health and healing. How many of you like salt? How many of you get a bowl of soup and you put salt in it even before you've tasted it? How many people really like the French fries, maybe even add more salt onto the French fries? Well, none of that's good. Who says? Harvard University, in a new study, they're saying that salty diets are linked to narrowed arteries in the heart and neck. So the more salt you consume, the greater risk of clogged heart and neck arteries, and that means then you're going to have plaque, and that means atherosclerosis, and that leads to a heart attack and a stroke. This was published in a recent issue of the European Heart Journal and included 10,700 people 50 to 64, and they were eating too much salt, too much sodium, and they did 24-hour urine collections and showed this is not good. You're going to have a high risk of atherosclerosis. The higher the participant's urinary sodium, the greater the amount of artery narrowing plaque in their neck and hearts, the carotid artery in particular. And then they end up with what is mildly elevated blood pressure of 140 over 90. Not good. This suggests that even people with high blood pressure should watch their salt intake. And one of the things you can do is you can have celery juice or celery seed extract. And also have yourself some beet juice, non-sodium beet juice. That'll help bring down blood pressure. All right. And acupuncture also can help with blood pressure that's elevated. Now from San Diego State University, a new study, strawberries, yes, regular organic strawberries, I might add, can improve cognitive function as you get older. Simply a pint of daily strawberries, and you can eat them raw, or you can juice them, and or you can throw them into a smoothie. But if you're taking them on a daily basis, it improves cognitive function, lowers blood pressure, and is very high in antioxidants. That's what a randomized clinical trial found. This was presented at the American Society of Nutrition. And so why not just have this every day? I like blueberries, wild blueberries in particular, and strawberries and raspberries. All your berries, start your day with that. And this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study. So it was really a good study. And so you're gonna lower your blood pressure. That's a big one. That's in addition to what I just mentioned. Now, long ago, back I believe it was around 1974, I published a book about alcohol and nutrition. And I showed that any amount of alcohol is toxic. Now you can get alcohol-free wine and alcohol-free beer. And but a lot of Americans, they like the feel, kind of that slightly euphoric, disconnected from reality, say what you want when you're consuming alcohol. You've heard the notion, well, a few drinks and they loosen up. Not good. This is from Peking University in China. This study, conducted by researchers from the Peking University and Oxford Population Health Study, shed light on the susceptibility of men to 60 diseases all related to alcohol consumption. The study titled Alcohol Consumption, the Risk of More Than 200 Diseases in Chinese Men, was published in the prestigious journal Nature Medicine. Alcohol consumption under any circumstances poses a significant global health threat, with previous research highlighting its strong association with diseases like liver cirrhosis, stroke, and various types of cancer, colorectal cancer, stomach cancer, esophageal cancer. Yeah. However, there's been a lack of a systematic investigation into the overall medical impact of drinking within a specific population. So this is specific to the Chinese population, and they found that it really makes a big difference. It hurts you at the genetic level and changes the expression of your genes. Yeah. So don't have alcohol in any amount, or you can end up, in this study, confirming 28 separate alcohol-related diseases. So, something to think about. And by the way, gout, cataracts, fractures, gastric ulcers, all contributed by the use of alcohol. Another study, this is from University of Wisconsin, the brain imaging of your parents shows how you may actually inherit the genetic expression, what we call epigenetics, epi meaning the larger environment, and the genes in your body of your parents' anxiety. Now, whether it is the mother or father or both that are anxious, and it's an anxiety that most people learn to live with. They just identify, well, I'm kind of a hyper person, or I'm kind of a nervous person. Well, no, we're not born that way. But if our parents, grandparents, seven generations back, if persons were anxious on a regular chronic basis, and we all know people are like that, then that can be passed on in the genes to the child. So that's important, all right? So we have to look at some of our behavior today and ask, why am I acting this way? Why am I so fearful? Why am I so insecure? Why do I get into a relationship and have way too many needs that I'm asking this person to fulfill, and it just crushes the life out of the relationship? Why? It may not be you in this moment. It may be your genes expressing themselves. Until you focus upon that, you can use regressive hypnosis to change it. You can use tapping therapy. That's very good. And you can use psychoanalysis. But positive affirmations to look at every problem will make the big difference. We all have problems. No one in this audience, no one born is going to go through life without different crises and traumas, being betrayed and used, sometimes by our own family members. But it's how you respond to that that makes a difference. So keep that in mind, please. And when you're upping your intake of omega-3 fatty acids, it can protect your hearing, University of Gulf and Tufts University. So the more omega-3 fatty acids within a range you need, the better your hearing. We also know it better your heart and cognitive improvements and actually delaying death. That's the DHA fraction of the omega-3 fatty acids. It's maintaining auditory integrity. And that's important because when you have better auditory function, you're going to help reduce the risk of age-related hearing loss, which a lot of people have. And they had over 100,000 people in that study. So it was a big study and a good one. And finally, from the University of Virginia, inflammation discovery could slow aging and prevent age-related disease. The University of Virginia School of Medicine researchers have discovered a key driver of chronic inflammation that accelerates aging, a finding that could lead to longer, healthier lives, and the possible prevention of age-related conditions like deadly heart disease and devastating brain disorders. The harmful inflammation is driven by upper calcium signaling in the mitochondria of certain immune cells, researchers found. And mitochondria are the power generators in all cells, and they rely heavily upon calcium signaling. And this is what was found. So as we age, our mitochondria, our energy factories, and the immune cells, called macrophages, lose their ability to take up and use calcium. This leads to calcium inflammation because you got chronic inflammation from too much calcium. And so there are ways of approaching this. Chelation therapy is one, and then having your blood checked to see whether or not you have this in your system. Anyway, the researchers believe that increasing calcium uptake by the mitochondria macrophages could prevent the inflammation and its terrible effects. Because macrophages reside in all the body's organs, including your brain, targeting them with appropriate therapies can help slow age-associated neurodegenerative diseases. So I think that's important. It's a good study. And that's the latest on health and healing. A couple things. I hope that you had a chance to see the debate that I did last night on the Progressive Commentary Hour. And as I said I would wait to the end, allowing my guest to present the information. I can see whether I agreed or disagreed with any point, but I don't interrupt people, because then all you end up, there's not a debate, you end up with an argument. And therefore, the context and the content is missed. And we have to be patient and listen and wait. And I waited till the end to challenge what I felt was inappropriate or wrong. Anyhow, I know a lot of you didn't have a chance to watch it, though we broke a record last night for a total number of people watching a progressive commentary hour. So we're going to be doing, try to do, one debate per month. And we're going to find people who are really up to the task. And my guest was, she graduated top of her class at Yale, Oxford University, and Stanford University School of Law. So no slouch academically, but that doesn't mean that the argument's going to be correct, because the academic background is substantial. But we're going to take on all the important issues that you do not see people having civil discussion and dialogue on, one per month. So we're going to replay that on Friday noon's program, for those of you who couldn't listen last evening. Also, a lot of people have given us a tremendous amount of positive feedback. John LaBelle, I think he is the longest serving professor at Pratt Institute, and he's been there 45 years, 50 years. Anyhow, he is the publisher of the Gary Nall newsletter. We work together on it. I provide the content, and he gets it out to everyone every morning. I get mine at 6 o'clock. And there's a lot of information I put in there that I don't have time to put in my daily show. Also, articles that you may not have heard, commentaries, essays, they're all in there. Recipes and good information. If you're interested, just go to GaryNall.com, look under newsletter, and you can sign up. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I like to tie issues together to show you the integration of concepts. I'm not a monotheistic thinker, meaning I don't just have one point of view on one issue and one truth and one reality that I adhere to, much like a person in a cult. I don't engage in groupthink. So when I suggest that if you're interested in health, people say, yeah, we want to hear about health. What would happen, for example, if one day you turn on this program and it's not there? And you look around, you see that it has been deplatformed for disinformation. We think, well, where do I go now? So you go over to some other platform, and they're all gone. There is no such thing as an alternative program anywhere in America. That could happen. But how do we get from where we're at now, where at least you have an opportunity to see this, even though this will not go on any algorithm? It'll only be known to those people who know we exist and tune it on. That's because for a long time now, the major social platforms, Google, Facebook, YouTube, Wikipedia, Twitter, have been working together with corporate interest and government agencies, from the White House directly, the Justice Department, the CIA, the FBI, Homeland Security. They all work together. But we thought that was a conspiracy theory. You couldn't prove it, so therefore they would demean you and try to cancel you for even suggesting it. But then along came Elon Musk, making a terrible business decision. He bought Twitter, lost a fortune in it, but then he revealed the truth when he showed the actual emails communicating, destroy this person, cancel that person, get rid of that, and allow pro-establishment views on COVID and on any other issue. And protect those in power that have committed crimes so nothing goes there against them. But now we know the truth. It's embarrassed them, but they double down. So what if I told you that a person who was talking 2 years ago about how you will own nothing and you'll be happy, he was right. And now we're seeing it. But how do you own nothing? How do we get there? That's what they've been building. Unelected people, all about profit and power, not about helping us. We now have smart cities. We now have 15-minute cities where within 15 minutes, everything you need to live your life, you'll have. But you got to get chipped. Well, they didn't say Chip. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're going to see today, and I'm going to read the comments, because it's in French. Klaus Schwab is saying, literally, at a whole conference, we're going to put a chip in your brain and others in other parts of your body, and we'll control you. And Harari is saying that there is no God, you know, and you're just useless, worthless eaters. We'll take care of you. And now they're saying universal income. That's how we take care of the vast majority of people. They're poor. Well, they made them poor. Well, that's not the issue. The issue is, what do we do with all these poor people? We give them a guaranteed universal income. Let's say 2,000 euros a month. But in return, they have to be chipped. And they tell you this. Who says that? One of the world leaders, the young leaders, at the World Economic Forum said that. And we have that. And we're going to show you. Harari saying that. Klaus Schwab saying it. One of the people that became a whistleblower just in the last week or two is telling us the truth. But how are they going to do this? Simple. They're going to take away all currencies except a digital currency. So everything you own, your house, your car, your condo, everything you own, you have to give them, and they'll give you a value for it that they determine, and it'll be a currency, a digital currency, like a coin, but not a physical coin, and one that they can control whether they're allowing you to buy or sell something. They're controlling every part of your life. They'll control the food because they're trying to take over all farming to have only genetically engineered industrial farming. They control it. Now, they're not going to have to do this for themselves, but we will. So very shortly, we're talking about in the next month, they're going to be introducing these principles in the United States, try to get them through. I believe if we make enough people aware of this, we can stop it. But if we don't, if the average person continues to be living kind of in a detached reality, filled with apathy and indifference or fear and anxiety, as we did with COVID, then they win. So, I'm going to show you some clips now. I'm going to show you a clip that starts with a person, the Morrises. They have a website. They do really good broadcasting, and they're discussing this in depth and showing you this is happening now in Sweden and other countries, and they're introducing it now in the United States. All right, but they explain it in great detail. And within their explaining it, you'll see the professor of economics, who's one of the world leaders of the young new leaders at the World Economic Forum, like Justin Trudeau. He's explaining this about the chip in the skin. He's saying this. And then you'll also see a clip of Klaus Schwab telling you they're putting it in your brain. Now, I'm going to narrate that part in English, but you can see it by going to PRN.live, scrolling down to the archives, then scrolling down to Gary Noll, and you'll be able to watch these clips. That's just the introduction to the topic today. Because without freedom of choice, you have no health. You only have what they're allowing you, and they're not into health. They're not into organic, and they're not into vitamins. They're not into yoga and meditation. They're not into anything. They're into power, genetically engineered meat, which is toxic, eating insects, which is toxic, taking away farmland all around the world like they're doing now in the largest farming community in Europe and the Netherlands. They're taking it away. Fortunately, the farmers fought back, and now they've stopped that. Now to the clip.
Here's a question. Would you let someone implant a microchip into your hand if you would receive $2,000 a month in return for getting a chip put in your hand? You heard me right. We'll give you universal basic income, basically, 2,000 euros, $2,000 a month, if you allow us to put a microchip in your hand. That's exactly what's about to happen as part of the rollout of the central bank digital currencies. That's a carrot for them to rope you into this mess. We'll get to that part of the story in a minute, the chip implantation process. Not the corn chip, as Dan said in our chat, but a actual metallic tracking chip. But a new report just published this week by the Bank for International Settlements explains how our new digital money system is about to work. We've been warning you that this was coming for a long time on this show. Also, we weren't the only ones predicting this. It was predicted in a little book, you might have heard of it, called The Bible, The Mark of the Beast. For one thing, this new system, this is how this new system would operate. According to them, the Bank for International Settlements, the new reserve currency, forget the dollar as you know it, basically. This will be the new reserve currency, which is how they want to label it and how they are labeling it. This would be used to settle all transactions. As everyone moves away from the U.S. dollar right now, this seems like perfect timing to be moving to this new system. So are they purposefully torpedoing the U.S. dollar in preparation for a global new reserve currency? One might wonder, right? We don't believe in conspiracy theories around here, but you have to wonder. It could include the confiscation of all property, physical property. By assigning it, every real world item would receive its own unique digital token. So what do you guys think about this, right? This idea that they could, I'm not saying they're going to, but you know, your car, your house, all of these sort of physical items that need a token process, you have to get them digitally tokenized in order for you to claim ownership of these items. No more selling cars without a digital token, right? No black market of selling cars. They all have to be tokenized. They all have to have a digital tracking ID to know exactly who owns them through this, what they call this transparent process.
So it's like a blockchain for the world.
Right. I mean, it would be on the blockchain, right? Everything would be, everyone would be given a tokenized digital ID. And I'll explain more about exactly the tokenization process in a moment. But basically, the idea that if you don't comply with this, then we're going to take your property and tokenize it ourselves is the idea. And they won't come out and say this, but that's exactly what some people are worried about, is that they would take your items, they would take your physical property and do it for you. Or confiscate it altogether if you're not willing to comply. And think of it like contraband. It would be considered contraband. Imagine trying to go through the airport or airport security with that laptop that you didn't have tokenized, so there's no digital footprint of it. Oh, what is that? What is that item that you're carrying there? Why do you have that there? Oh, sorry, I didn't have it registered with the government. I don't have a digital ID for that item? No worry, we'll take it off your hands. So your digital wallet, your car, your house, your laptop, your phone, all of it assigned a digital token. Inside those tokens would be a set of rules for how each item can and cannot be used, so that each person can be controlled and conditioned directly by the central bank. You've used your digital wallet to buy your allotment of beef or chicken this month? You're cut off. You're cut off. Your wallet is not limited. Your wallet is now limited until next month. And by the way, you think this is like a conspiracy theory. The Federal Reserve, literally on their website, loves and talks about the benefits of expiring currency, the expiration of currency. And hey, China's already doing it in part. So there's already limitations and expiration of currency. We already have this. And the Fed is openly talking about this on their website. Think this is a dream? Okay, just wait until it happens. Let's actually let them describe. So here is, after this Bank of International Settlements rolled this out last week, here is their tokenization process in their own words. Just watch sort of the, well, let me know if you think that this is creepy in any way. Watch.
Tokenization is more than just a digital representation of money and assets. It involves digital representation on a programmable platform, which means that tokens can incorporate the rules and logic governing transfers, as well as the information about the asset itself. Now, currently, money and other claims reside in separate databases that are connected through third-party messaging systems, meaning that transactions need to be reconciled separately before being settled with finality. Tokenization makes all this one seamless operation. Tokenization is well suited to resolve incentive and information problems. Think of an example where a buyer would like to pay when the goods are delivered, while the seller would like to deliver the goods when the buyer pays. Tokenization can solve this problem by executing both transactions at the same time.
So
two real world applications.
So they talk about this. They talk about this tokenization as solving these problems, right? It involves the representing the ownership rights of real world assets as digital tokens on a blockchain. In other words, you own a car, and that's confirmed because there's a digital token saying you do, and it's confirmed on the blockchain. You wouldn't need to go do title searches and all of your antiquated things like that when selling your car. It's already on the blockchain and confirmed that you own it. It's a digital certificate of authenticity. They'll sell it to us as a way to speed up the banking process, as he was just doing, as Hoi Shin was just doing. Right now, there are 10 steps in order to wire money to someone. It's long, especially if you're not using your bank. Like if you're, you know, doing a wire from like Bank of America to PNC Bank, there are multiple steps. Each bank needs to verify that you are in fact sending the money. They need to basically send a request. So now tokenization and CBDCs would wire money that can do this in one step, one verification process instead of 10 steps. So it sounds great. That's how they will sell it to us. It's easy. It's faster. But what if government controls the blockchain? And what if the main currency is a central bank digital currency run by the Fed? And you want to use Bitcoin? You want to use Dogecoin? You want to use cash? Sorry. That's outlawed now. You can't do that. Oh, you're using this illegal currency? Sorry, you're going to jail. We already see the move towards trying to get rid of digital currency that's not run by the federal government. They don't like Bitcoin. They absolutely don't like a lot of these other cryptocurrencies. Sorry, that's outlawed. You need to use America's digital currency or the EU's digital currency. That is controlled by a central power. You don't need to imagine it because it's already happening. But more importantly, it's all about the control. Buried towards the end of this report is this nugget on who would control these transactions. And again, this is why no one's covering this story, because it's nuanced and it takes time to explain this all. So you're just going to wind up one day with this thing in your wallet, a digital wallet, and no one's going to explain this to you. In this report, buried deep in this, 40 pages deep, I stumbled across this, the governance section of a unified ledger could follow existing arrangements whereby central banks and regulated private partners participants take part in governance under established rules. For example, when money and payments are involved in a ledger, the central bank will necessarily play a role as the provider of the ultimate settlement asset. Its specific involvement in governance arrangements could take various forms, much as it does in the case of traditional payment systems, where public ownership, regulation, and oversight, as well as private mutual ownership, are viable options. So in other words, the Fed will play a necessary role as the provider and the ultimate settlement decider in these transactions. So the central bank, of course, will control these transactions. And it means that it represents trillions of dollars in potential transactions of these governments. They stand to make a lot of money. And according to the report released just recently by the Global Financial Markets Association, this is the Boston Consulting Group and others, estimate as part of this report, look here on your screen, the value of tokenized illiquid assets will increase from roughly $0.3 trillion in 2022 to $16 trillion in transactions by 2030. That in 7 more years, we will jump up by almost $15.5 trillion in additional settlements. Richard Werner is an economist who is a World Economic Forum insider. Think of him as a whistleblower against these globalists. He was chosen by Klaus Schwab at the time as a global leader. Here he explains how the CBDC or central bank digital currency will start off on our phones as an app, but then move to something far more nefarious, an implant in your hand. Yes, a chip in your hand. Listen.
And what people don't mention is, what do these CBDCs actually look like? You know, at the moment, there's a bit of talk about this being phone-based apps. And yes, that is the initial phase. But what was already ready around 2015 is the ultimate goal, what they really want. Apparently, I was told by a central banker, is, you know, CBDCs looks like a small grain of rice that they want to put under your skin, which is, in my view, a violation of human dignity. And they realize there is a hurdle. So to get people to accept this, there will be, you know, why suddenly? all the billionaires saying, let's have universal basic income. Because the story is going to be, oh, now we've created this vast unemployment and disruption and crises. Well, we need universal basic income. You will get 2,000 euros into your account every month. But of course, to run this efficiently, we need to use the latest technology. So, you know, you need the CBDC chip implant.
Okay. So you get this universal basic income.
Right. That's the carrot.
But you can't actually then make any more than that. That will be like, you have to have what everybody has then.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you make more money than that, or you probably have to qualify at a certain threshold, but, you know, would you be willing to go along with, this is the question, and it's going to work.
I guess there's, that's my, so many extrapolation people. Is like, the scary part is this becomes the Hunger Games. You just get your portion, right? And then you have no rights to anything above that.
And I think, when, like we talked about it before, it's like, it's going to target the poorest people because they're the ones going to be wanting to get on board with this because it's going to make life easier for them. It's like, you get this stipend plus your income, and this is going to make it easier for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think this is going to work. And this is how they will get people. We will put you on a universal basic income, and you will be given a certain set of parameters how you can use this income. And you're going to have to get a chip in your hand for tracking. That's how you will access it, right? And additionally, you will then be capped at certain purchases. Your carbon footprint will be tracked. What are you buying? Where are you going? And the idea, of course, that, oh, this is only for purchases. We won't be able to track your physical location, your whereabouts. Really? Communication, how is it being tracked? Is it Bluetooth, near field communication? I just walk up and tap it against any kind of like a soda machine. We've already seen them rolling it out at different grocery stores. We see people in Sweden are jumping on board with this, wanting to use this on a regular basis. So there's people already electing to use this, wanting to use this. And they'll do this with the promise of basic income. $2,000 a month. Would you do it? Let us know in the chat if you would do that. This is not some fever dream, by the way. Where was this? Where did this come from? This was explained in great detail by Klaus Schwab himself in 2016. Listen.
Well, that's sobering, isn't it? Just to repeat, it is the intent of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, Dr. Harari, that, and this was a 2015 conference, that they intend to, as he said, put a chip in your clothing, in your body, and in your brain. Why would they want to do that? Why would you allow them to do that? Depends upon how they set it up and how they sell it. And that's important. And so you'll have choices. They're going to make it very enticing, much like they did 5G. But before you accept that what they're saying is in your best interest and not their interest, and taking control you have over your life now and using that for themselves, you have no control, think well about the power of freedom to make a choice, unencumbered. But to make a good choice, you have to have good information, especially information that shows you there is a natural and healthy way of going through a crisis. And we haven't had that. We've had a lot of disinformation, but now we see that it's officially driven. And at least they're not hiding it. They don't have to. Because about half of Americans would push back, or more. I don't know anyone who would say, you own my car, my house, my wristwatch, anything I have, you own it, and you're going to give me some credit voucher on an electronic digital currency where you also have the right to lock that account so I can't receive or spend money, or you'll have an ability to track what I buy and say yes or no based upon my carbon footprint or what you consider a useful purchase or a non-useful purchase. I don't see many people saying yes to that unless they are in abject poverty, in which case, out of necessity, many of them will say, I'll take your £2,000 a month and I don't need any more than that, because I won't owe anything with that, because one of the conditions will probably be they'll forgive debt. So if someone's forgiving your debt and giving you a guaranteed income, and you don't owe anything, It's just like someone who has multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's. Now, if there was a legitimate way through genes research to change the genetic expression and therefore reduce or eliminate your symptoms, any reasonable person say yes. Because unless you've suffered from neurological diseases, you can't appreciate how a person suffers. That's their whole focus of their life. But if you want to put a chip in someone's brain because you want to read their thoughts or control their actions or be able to put them into some form of dopamine or serotonin state where they're kind of blissed out, they're in a kind of a soma, Aldous Huxley's idea of keep the population in a soma state, meaning so chilled out that they don't respond to anything. They just do what they're told. So all that is coming. It's here in Sweden. It's already been used in Canada. And so there'll be opposition. There'll be many of us writing articles, testifying before state or federal government committees. And I want to say good for the committees that are testifying people under oath, subpoenaing them, because we would never have had this from the existing administration. They hid everything. Now their secrets are coming out. One of the people who you may feel is a different type of Democrat, the old-fashioned type, like Robert Kennedy Sr. Robert Kennedy Jr. is trying to follow in his father's footsteps. His brother and his uncle were heavily aligned initially and supported by their father, Joseph Kennedy, with the moneyed interest. But that changed. The Kennedys kind of switched gears once they saw the reality of how power is done. They didn't like J. Edgar Hoover. Robert Kennedy had already determined he was going to fire him, and no one fired, Hoover. He was utterly corrupt. And so there's the belief that he was assassinated because of the enemies he made. This was both Kennedys. So Robert comes from that background of wanting to do the right thing for the right reasons for the people. And he's been universally attacked. Nothing has he said that is inappropriate. He's been completely accurate, where none of the other candidates are accurate about COVID and the consequences and what Fauci knew and what he didn't know. And for that, he is also attacked as a vaccine denialist. He's not. In fact, he said, all my children, my wife, myself, have been vaccinated for everything. It's just this one vaccine that we had problems with. He told the truth. Science is on his side. Yet he was vilified. Here are two clips back to back of him being vilified and defended by some reporters for the Hill and Tulsi Gabbard. Let's go to those two clips back to back.
Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is facing steep opposition from the Democratic establishment, and now political action groups are joining the push to keep him from getting on the ballot. Friend of the show and podcaster Sabrina Salvati highlighted the extent of this effort, specifically groups wrangling voters via text to thwart RFK Jr.'s run. In a recent tweet, Sabby denounced this, saying, quote, "They're already kicking people or texting people to kick RFK Jr. off the ballot. I don't support his campaign, but this is wild." Here to dig deeper into the anti-RFK Jr. camp is Sabrina. Welcome, Sabrina.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So it sounds like this text that came through, "I'm begging, can you sign the petition to ban Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the ballot," came from Progressive Turnout PAC. Do you think it's going to increase voter turnout by kicking candidates off of the Democratic primary ballot, especially for progressives? What do you make of this?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of Americans aren't even paying attention to the political landscape right now. So some of them, I think a lot of them don't even know that this is happening, to be honest. But this particular organization, Progressive Turnout PAC, they are aligned with the Democratic Party. I think it's important for people to know that One of the individuals that has donated heavily to this particular organization is Dustin Moskovitz. Now, Dustin is a co-founder of Facebook. So here you have a social media platforms donating to political organizations. Now, why should that be concerning for people? If we go back to the interview that Mark Zuckerberg had with Joe Rogan, he explained that it was political. The Democratic Party reached out to them and said that they did not want them to feature the Hunter Biden laptop story. They wanted them to suppress that organization. So here you have social media platforms working hand in hand with the Democratic Party. And this is very much a problem. You can see this, I think it's going to escalate in 2024 as to whether or not what they decide, who they're going to platform and who they're going to suppress. But that text message did come through. A number of people have received that text message as well. And I think everybody should be concerned, whether you support RFK Jr.'s campaign or not, who were they to tell you to kick someone off of the ballot? So this is very concerning.
Certainly, and it's deeply undemocratic. I mean, this is the nomination to figure out who's going to be the Democratic Party's candidate. What is the DNC, what is the Biden camp afraid of? Are they actually afraid of this challenge from RFK Jr.? Is this evidence of that?
I believe so. Unfortunately, a lot of the Democrat politicians that have been heavily preaching about protecting our democracy, which I would argue we don't have a real democracy, but those individuals actually just want you to vote for the candidate that the Democratic Party has selected. And the candidate that they've selected is Joe Biden. They believe that just because he's already sitting in the Oval Office, that we should just hand over re-election to him and that he should not have any type of challenge, whether it's from the Democratic Party or third party or independent. And that's really unfortunate, but this is how this game works. And I think hopefully more people will wake up to this and push back against the Democratic Party for being, you know, trying to do this and being so vocal about it early on. It shows you that they're very much afraid that Joe Biden could lose re-election. But I think people need to understand, we have to start looking at solutions in reference to this type of situation. There are two things that you can do. Number one, you can stop doing their bidding. Stop voting for the candidate that they select and tell you should vote for just because that person fits the status quo and is backed by Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. And two, for those of you that live in states that are ballot initiative states, you should run BI measures to publicly finance elections. Now, this is something that needs to start at the local level, because in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people that are entitled to buy elections. So we're going to have to start working on this locally. But at the end of the day, the Democratic Party selects the candidate that they want. And anyone who goes outside of that status quo, they'll do whatever they can to make sure that they don't win. Look at what happened during the Democratic primary debates in 2020. Throughout the debates, they changed the rules so that some candidates could be removed, like Tulsi Gabbard, and so that the candidates that they want could join, like Mike Bloomberg. Oh, we don't have a real democracy. If we had a real democracy, third-party candidates wouldn't have to fight so hard to get on the ballot. They wouldn't be trying to kick people off of the ballot. You know, it's really a disgrace. Here it is, 2023, and this is the way our political system operates.
For sure.
Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is facing steep opposition from the Democratic establishment, and now political action groups are joining the push to keep him from getting on the ballot. Friend of the show and podcaster Sabrina Salvati highlighted the extent of this effort, specifically groups wrangling voters via text to thwart RFK Jr.'s run. In a recent tweet, Sabby denounced this, saying, quote, "They're already kicking people or texting people to kick RFK Jr. off the ballot. I don't support his campaign, but this is wild." Here to dig deeper into the anti-RFK Jr. camp is Sabrina. Welcome, Sabrina.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So it sounds like this text that came through, "I'm begging, can you sign the petition to ban Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the ballot," came from Progressive Turnout PAC. Do you think it's going to increase voter turnout by kicking candidates off of the Democratic primary ballot, especially for progressives? What do you make of this?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of Americans aren't even paying attention to the political landscape right now. So some of them, well, I think a lot of them don't even know that this is happening, to be honest. But this particular organization, Progressive Turnout PAC, they are aligned with the Democratic Party. I think it's important for people to know that one of the individuals that has donated heavily to this particular organization is Dustin Moskovitz. Now, Dustin is a co-founder of Facebook. So here you have a social media platforms donating to political organizations. Now, why should that be concerning for people? If we go back to the interview that Mark Zuckerberg had with Joe Rogan, he explained that it was political. The Democratic Party reached out to them and said that they did not want them to feature the Hunter Biden laptop story. They wanted them to suppress that organization. So here you have social media platforms working hand in hand with the Democratic Party. And this is very much a problem. You can see this, I think it's going to escalate in 2024 as to whether or not what they decide, who they're going to platform and who they're going to suppress. But that text message did come through. A number of people have received that text message as well. And I think everybody should be concerned, whether you support RFK Jr.'s campaign or not, who were they to tell you to kick someone off of the ballot? So this is very concerning.
Certainly, and it's deeply undemocratic. I mean, this is the nomination to figure out who's going to be the Democratic Party's candidate. What is the DNC, what is the Biden camp afraid of? Are they actually afraid of this challenge from RFK Jr.? Is this evidence of that?
I believe so. Unfortunately, a lot of the Democrat politicians that have been heavily preaching about protecting our democracy, which I would argue we don't have a real democracy, but those individuals actually just want you to vote for the candidate that the Democratic Party has selected. And the candidate that they've selected is Joe Biden. They believe that just because he's already sitting in the Oval Office, that we should just hand over re-election to him and that he should not have any type of challenge, whether it's from the Democratic Party or third party or independent. And that's really unfortunate, but this is how this game works. And I think hopefully more people will wake up to this and push back against the Democratic Party for being, you know, trying to do this and being so vocal about it early on. It shows you that they're very much afraid that Joe Biden could lose re-election. But I think people need to understand, we have to start looking at solutions in reference to this type of situation. There are two things that you can do. Number one, you can stop doing their bidding. Stop voting for the candidate that they select and tell you should vote for just because that person fits the status quo and is backed by Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. And two, for those of you that live in states that are ballot initiative states, you should run BI measures to publicly finance elections. Now, this is something that needs to start at the local level, because in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people that are entitled to buy elections. So we're going to have to start working on this locally. But at the end of the day, the Democratic Party selects the candidate that they want. And anyone who goes outside of that status quo, they'll do whatever they can to make sure that they don't win. Look at what happened during the Democratic primary debates in 2020. Throughout the debates, they changed the rules so that some candidates could be removed, like Tulsi Gabbard, and so that the candidates that they want could join, like Mike Bloomberg. We don't have a real democracy. If we had a real democracy, third-party candidates wouldn't have to fight so hard to get on the ballot. They wouldn't be trying to kick people off of the ballot. You know, it's really a disgrace. Here it is, 2023, and this is the way our political system operates.
For sure.
It tells you a lot that his campaign manager is Dennis Kucinich, one of the more ethical, honest, and populist-based legislators we ever had. And he was so effective, they gerrymandered him, his district, and he lost because of that. Not because the people didn't like him, not because he didn't do a good job. He did. But Dennis is a very ethical and conscientious person. Whether you vote for Kennedy or not, understand that, take a look at everything we're facing today. Do you want more of that? Or do you, I'd love to see multiple parties. I'd love to see multiple third-party candidates as well. And also, I'd like to see all the money taken out of elections. Right now, it costs about $100 million to win a seat for Senate. It costs billions of dollars, $4 to $8 billion, to win the presidency. The average American's not paying for all that. The special billionaire class are, and large PAC groups are. And you never know who they are. But whatever they want, when someone's elected with that kind of money, that's who they honor. The pharmaceutical industry, the food industry, the banking industry, they have people that are lobbying every day of the week. In fact, there's about 20 lobbyists for every legislator, minimally, influencing them. I'd like just to see all lobbying banned and all money taken out of elections. It could happen. It could be done. Oh, by the way, I want to go now to a short clip. It's a very short clip, but I'm going to do the full clip tomorrow, which is about 40 minutes. And this is a 22-year-old African-American podcaster who is vilified, and yet she came from a background of supporting the most radicalized and pro-racist views, meaning she viewed all whites and all cops as bad, evil, racist. And then she had something that happened in her life that allowed her to do some homework, and she began to alter her perception. But here's something she said I think you'll find of interest.
Anything but liberal. You have a 22-year-old girl who wants to come and speak at a college campus and is met with just a barrier to even come and espouse views that might challenge the mainstream held views of not just students, but faculty members. And that should be the scariest part. We're all young people. We all go through our trials and tribulations, and we certainly love to judge people. There was nothing I loved more in the world when I was 17 years old than judging somebody, calling them a racist, and telling them that they should shut up. That's normal for young people.
Well, I know that there are certainly teenagers who feel that way, but I believe the majority of teenagers realize, especially if they come from a grounded family and family values, that you can't just trust what the internet says or those spokespersons who their victim, their whole mindset is you're a victim and therefore you're the prey. Let's go after the oppressors. That'll be a discussion for tomorrow. Now I have something I want to share, and that is I've been to San Francisco many times. Magnificent city. It has all of the commerce and the uniqueness of a big city like New York or Houston, but it's actually a small, it's not large. I used to walk it at night. I'd finish all my lectures, television appearances when I was out there doing, I must have done 40 trips to San Francisco on tour, and then I like to walk. I do in New York too. Every night I would take a break around 11 o'clock and walk down to Lincoln Center and walk around the fountain and then walk back up Broadway to my office at 83rd. It's just a way of stretching and relaxing, and it was calming. Well, I used to do the same thing in San Francisco. Wonderful place, beautiful buildings, great architecture, and wow, get up on that hill, you're overlooking the bay, it's exquisite. I even went out there to do the first San Francisco Marathon, and the person I trained won the gold medal. In any case, the people of San Francisco are just wonderful. And now it's not. The people are still there. They're nice. And it still has a lot of income because of Silicon Valley. The multi-billionaires are there. And they live in an area that is not gated. You can't gate it off. And sometimes it's deceptive. You look at a house and you say, well, that's just a normal row house. That nothing special about that. Yeah, it's like $5 million. You know, a little sliver of raw land is like, in some places, $10, $15 million. So the stealing that's going on there, the breaking into houses that are going on, is really unprecedented. In fact, I saw a video of a person who is a tech billionaire, has his house there, has cameras over the house, had to hire a guard to sleep overnight in his house. And in spite of that, he still was broken into multiple times. And so then at some point you got to ask, well, you know, this is not the right place to live. But that's never happened before. But then you go down to the Barcadero. It's like Fifth Avenue, but it's aesthetically far more beautiful. It's very tranquil. It's like a giant mall that she's going on and on and on across streets. And you're all on this elevation. It's, I think, two or three stories. And you see all these shops. Now, that's where your spas, restaurants, clothing stores, high-end facial cosmetics, all of those are there, hundreds. And it could take you 20 minutes to walk from one end to the other and look in the shops. And I used to go by there just to see what's new out there. Today, it's completely empty. In fact, the hundreds of stores, there's only an overnight medical center that's open 24/7 for emergencies, and a nail salon at the very beginning. That's it. Every single store is closed. Then you look up to the beautiful buildings, beautiful hotel, one of the most nicest hotels in the United States was there, one of the largest, I think 2,000 rooms, closed. And then you have the other big hotel behind it closed. And in fact, the developer owed $700 million on it and gave it back to the people that financed it. And then you go down Market Street, a main street, like you walking down Madison Avenue, and almost everything is closed. And not just closed, boarded up. Why? Because the city allowed shoplifting no longer to be considered a serious crime. You could steal up to $950, nothing's going to happen to you. In fact, you can't even touch the people and stop them from exiting a store. So needless to say, it didn't take long before the people who were those people of a mindset, which is a minor percentage of the population. But look, let's just say you own a small store and you sell suits of clothes. And on a normal day, you'll do $2,000 in business. That's enough to make it a little profit and pay for the cost that are tailor-made and all the expenses you have. But now a guy comes in with a shopping cart and he takes $950 out of the store. Then right behind him are 20 other people. They all come in, they all take $950. At the end of the day, you have no merchandise. You've lost $40,000, $50,000 that day. So you restock. How many days can you keep doing that before you go broke? And that's what happened. And who came to the relief of these people? No one. Unless you touch one of the people to try to take your clothes back, then you'd be arrested. You'd be arrested, not them. And so people just began to go from around the country to San Francisco. And then in comes their little tent cities, and debris is everywhere, feces is everywhere. The whole air smells when you can walk for a mile and you can't get that out of your nostrils. And defecating, drugging. One guy was interviewed, and in 2 days his heart stopped twice using drugs, fentanyl and another drug, and yet he goes right back at it. And the city now has lost control. Nobody wants to come to there for vacationing. Now, there are still beautiful sights in San Francisco, and there are places, little enclaves that are fine, and the rich or the well-to-do can go where they're not going to see these sights. But if you go downtown anywhere, you're going to see it and smell it. And so it's out of control. It at a certain point, no one wants to do a conference or a convention there. People don't want a vacation there. And yet just across the bridge, you have one of the wealthiest counties in America, Redding County. And you have University of California, Berkeley over there. And it's very prosperous. So you have wealthy people living in a very wealthy place where quality of life is fine as long as you don't go into the city itself or you don't go to certain places within the city. And we're not talking about marginal places way out by the docks. We're talking about main areas, main malls, main hotels, main right down in front of the best buildings. It's overrun. And the Honduran gangs supply drugs and charge the people who are homeless a tent fee. Nothing can be done. And yet people have not looked at Finland because Finland's a country that was able to reduce their homelessness from around somewhere around 36% of the down to 6%. And what they did was, I disagree with what they did, because when you look at the actual numbers of they buy people an apartment, nice apartments. They're not huge, but they're clean, they're new, they're nice. And they put the homeless people in there at the beginning. Now, to get in there, you don't have to get off drugs. You can still use drugs. And there's almost nothing you have to do. And then downstairs, they have people, social workers. I think it's 7 social workers per building. And then they can counsel people, but it's voluntary. And here's what they didn't tell when they were doing their metrics, and I looked at this and I said, that's stupid. If you don't help a person who has mental conditions or addiction problems or is in a deep depression because they're homeless, then they're not going to get out of homelessness. They may not be on the street, but the problem's not going to go away. Whereas if you do a different model, for example, if you were to go out into the state and get the state or the federal government, the state's more than capable of doing this, and you have into a foundation, you have land that is set aside an hour from the cities, and you could do this in every city in America, and then you build very ecologically sound and comfortable apartments in a beautiful way, so you have for single people, couples, and families. And you have one general cafeteria that's open throughout the day into the evening. You have medical clinic. You have counseling clinic. You have rehabilitation where you can detoxify people. You have job placement to help a person find a job. You have a transportation system that takes people back and forth to where they would work. And in a period of time, you have the tools to help a person get off the drugs, get off the alcohol, get out of deep moods. But that requires a whole team to assist in an environment that's away from the city, so they're not sleeping on the street and doing the drugs. The drugs are not allowed in these facilities. But you're helping them detoxify. And you can even do natural treatment detoxifications with high-dose vitamin C drips, which they don't go, they get detoxed very quickly, and they don't have all the problems that a person going cold turkey would have. That way, the city remains the city. It's still hospitable to the people living there. And still you're helping people. You're putting them in a beautiful environment in nature. And you can have walking trails. You can have gyms that people go to, yoga classes, Pilates classes, water aerobic classes. You can have community gardens where people can learn how to plant food. There's so much you can do if you do it in an environment that takes into account the object is not just to get a person to bed and roof over their head, but help them regain a sense of the quality of life and do so humanely. Even have a movie theater showing, you know, films that people would enjoy, a comedy club, etc. All that's possible if people didn't want to profit off other people's pain. There's an awful lot of profiting, a lot of politics, a lot of insider dealing, and that's one of the things that keeps this from happening. You know, it's just a suggestion. I'm going to look at the clock. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen today. Keep in mind, if I share some videos with you and clips of serious nature, that kind of give you that kind of sense of angst and, wow, I didn't know that was happening. What can I do about it? I'm always going to give you solutions to problems. But what if I didn't tell you about the problem? Then would you prepare for it when it happens? Probably not. But remember, at the beginning of COVID, I wrote a series of articles of how to build up your immune system, figuring most people are going to be infected, but as long as you have a strong immune system, you're going to lessen your likelihood of being hospitalized or dying. And that was actually proven to be the case. And those articles are still up there, still very much important. So I'll always give you what you need in a good way to help you with some of the potential problems we're facing. Have a nice day, everyone. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program.